Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Wednesday, November the 23rd. As we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. This is a good day to wrap up the week, look back at the week that has passed, and look ahead to the remainder of the year. So let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Are we allowed to say that, though? I want to make sure that we're allowed. I've checked the laws in New York State. They are ambivalent. They're ambivalent. It's depends on who you are, you know, and who you know.
Right, right. Well, here in Texas, we can still say it, but I am amazed, maybe I shouldn't be, by all of these people who are trying to demonize what is, you know, I'm not saying it's perfect holiday. Nothing is perfect. But I always thought it was one of the nicest holidays in American history, a nice family holiday. You say thanks to, you know, you give thanks for the good things you have, you know, maybe remember some of the people you've lost in the year. But I always thought it was a pretty nice holiday, and now they're trying to tell me that there's something evil in this holiday, Bill.
Well, they are trying to say that the holiday is built on stolen land. And that, you know, I've always wondered about that stolen land business and the indigenous peoples. I have nothing against indigenous peoples.
No.
I'm sure they're fine people. But where is it written that indigenous peoples were the only people allowed to live here? I mean, do you know how big the American continent is? I think at any one time, the population of indigenous peoples was large enough to populate the state of New York. I mean, mm-hmm. This is a huge continent. I want to know where it's written that we had to have someone's permission to immigrate here. Immigration is a fact of life all over the world.
Right.
And it exists on – that doesn't mean you should push people out. If there were crimes committed, they should be noted by history. But there were also apparently great relationships, as I understand it. And again, I'm not a historian of Thanksgiving, that the first Thanksgiving Day dinner included indigenous Americans and as guests. I suspect there was friction. I also suspect there was friction the other way of pilgrims, who now are called settlers, by the way. We're not supposed to call them pilgrims. We're supposed to call them settlers.
Okay.
Like they're set. We are settlers here.
Right.
The Jews are settlers in the land of their fathers in Israel. Everyone's a settler as long as they, unless of course they look different, then they're indigenous and victims. It's really silly. And what is so shocking about this kind of thing, all has originated in colleges and universities. And one of these days we're going to wake up and find these institutions aren't quite as noble as we've been led to believe. In fact, they have very mixed histories.
They do, and they're, you know, someone said that our colleges have become a national security problem.
Yes,
and,
they have.
You know, considering what they're teaching the young people, I can certainly believe it. But I always, you know, I came into the Thanksgiving story, as you know,
yes.
You know, as a Cuban immigrant, you know, so
yes.
I mean, and I wasn't born, you know, reading about Thanksgiving. It wasn't something I didn't really know anything about until we got here. And I always, you know, I always thought it was a very noble holiday. And I'm not saying that it was a perfect, you know, that there was a perfect holiday. But I always thought the idea of having one day a year where the family would get together and say thanks, I always thought that was a good idea. whether it was, you know, whether it was started by the pilgrims or it was, well, I mean, that I thought was the detail of, in the story. But I thought the story itself, the idea that a family would get together, have dinner and say thanks, I always thought that was a great idea, Bill.
It was, and it's such a great idea, in fact, that it was picked up by the big city political machines of recent centuries, and they would give to the poor in their area each year a Thanksgiving turkey so they could have a Thanksgiving. Now, they weren't entirely altruistic. They expected a vote in return, but they put a great deal of emphasis on Thanksgiving. And, you know, it reminds me of this nonsense that has also been going on in this country of renaming sports teams. You must not call it the Cleveland Indians, and of course the Washington team, the Redskins, now called the Washington Commanders. I have one question for the people who insist on doing this. Did anyone ever name a sports team after people they didn't admire?
That's right.
I mean, you know, it's not one ever called it the Cleveland bank robbers. Actually, when I was a Cub Scout, you were taught to admire Native Americans and to admire their traditions. And yet this whole thing has developed that we must change the name of the Atlanta Braves and this one and that one and all the others because those names are stolen and they didn't have the approval of the group that was involved. I mean, my goodness, if I knew that my group was being honored by a name of a national baseball team because they admired me or admired my group, I'd be flattered. But everything is turned around to be what it isn't. And
right.
I think some Americans may have reached the breaking point with that. I'm not so sure all Americans. I saw an analysis of the vote this morning by a very well-known writer who was just really frustrated over the fact that so many people in big cities voted in to office again the very people who created the problems in these big cities today. And
right.
it's very, very discouraging. It didn't happen everywhere, but sometimes political traditions, political ideology trumps everything, and that's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right, and I think you're right. I mean, I think the best example of that is New York. I mean, the best example of a city that could use, I mean, if there is an argument for a change, it would be New York City or the state of New York. And yet they went ahead and, you know, voted for the same people who put them in this mess. Now, that's a complicated thing. Maybe there's tradition in there. Maybe there's just ignorance. I don't know. But you're right. I mean, also, if you look at the other thing I wanted to mention, you're talking about the last vote. One of the reasons, the more I look at it, one of the reasons why the red wave never really materialized outside of Texas and Florida and Ohio and places like that is because of the young people. The young people were led to believe that the president of the United States could cancel their loans, Bill. And,
yes.
And this is, to me, this is amazing. This is amazing that there would be young people in the country. If anybody had come to me when I was in college and said, you know what, the president is going to cancel your loan, I would have said, why, do you think I'm stupid? I mean, you think I'm stupid to believe something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently,
well,
I guess there must be a lot of stupid people, Bill.
Well, there are a lot of uninformed people.
Yeah.
And we have to ask, in that case, who's doing the uninforming? It's the role of the press to report the news. The press is not performing that role. In fact, I don't even think that there are that many journalists around in large cities who think it is their role any longer. Their
right.
role apparently is to improve society, and we are being told that they have a special knowledge about how to do this because
right.
they got a job on a newspaper. I mean, they have this vision. You know, excuse me. When I was at the New York Times, I had a very wise editor. They existed in those days, who told me that in his view, the average journalist knows about 10% more than the general public. And I've come to believe that that's true, that the great knowledge that journalists are supposed to have is often non-existent or exists only in a very narrow area. that out there in the among the people is where the real knowledge and the real wisdom resides. And I think there's a lot to be said for that argument.
Yeah, I mean, the journalists that I've met over the years, I mean, I would say they're smart people. I wouldn't call them stupid, but they tend to, they're not smarter than the population. I mean, it's not like they're gifted people. I mean, they're smart, they're educated. I mean, that's fine. But I don't think they're smarter than the average population. I think a lot of people who are out there, you know, running businesses, and especially small businesses, are just as smart, if not smarter, than these so-called elite people, because I think they're dealing with more reality. If you're running a small business, you're dealing with more reality, I think, than if you're working at a newspaper. But I just, you know, I just find it appalling, Bill, that a university, I mean, that universities could actually mobilize people around the idea that, you know, you have to vote on the first Tuesday of November, because if you vote Democrat, the Democrats are going to cancel your loans. And that there are people who actually bought that scares the heck out of me, because what else are they believing, Bill?
Well, they're believing a lot of things, because when you go to school, you tend to believe the teacher. You kind of wonder why the teacher is there. Now, when I went to school, most teachers stayed away from giving us their political views. Apparently, that is no longer the case. That now, I heard one teacher say, well, we don't teach history the way we used to teach it. Well, why not? Tell me why you aren't. Well, apparently it's to be more inclusive. Well, you know, I'm all for inclusion, but I'm all for the truth as well. And it seems to me that the purpose of any educational institution is to seek the truth. I don't believe that is the purpose today. I think they believe that they have the truth, and they want to spread it around and change the nature of society.
Right. Well, not only do you believe that, Bill, some of these teachers are on video saying that.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they're on video saying, hey, we don't care what the parents think. You know, we're going to do this. And, you know, not only are they doing it on history, but they're doing it on other things that, you know, like sexuality and stuff like that, that has no business whatsoever in school. If there is one good thing that happened, though, Bill, in this last election, is that there was a tsunami school board level.
Yes, that was
wonderful. I think it's clear that from coast to coast, a lot of school boards are going to change, Bill.
Well, they have to, because now that doesn't mean they'll get an immediate result, because the school boards have to deal with the teachers' unions, and they have to deal with state education authorities, which are often very deeply ingrained into the political system. So the school boards will have their influence. The fact that there was this tsunami of school board elections, which went heavily conservative, tells us that apparent action, citizen action, works. It really does. Mm-hmm. When you can mount a campaign, when you care enough to go and do it, it can have its effect. Then the idea is to put the wishes of the people, the wishes of the parents, into practice. That's going to be a much harder thing, but the answer to that, it seems to me, or at least one of the answers to that, is school choice, which I believe is going to be one of the biggest issues in America in the last 5 years.
In the coming 5 years. No, you're exactly right. And in fact, there are already state legislators here in Texas who are putting forward bills, because we have a legislature next year, and that's one of the issues that will be discussed. And I'm convinced that some kind of school choice is going to happen here in Texas. And I think school choice, Bill, is going to have two consequences that a lot of people are not addressing. The first one, of course, is that it's going to make a lot of parents happy, because they'll be able to choose a school. And I think when you can have that kind of control over your kids' education, that's a good thing. But the other consequence that I don't think a lot of people are talking about, but I've been thinking a lot about this, is that it's going to make certain states more attractive to relocation. Because if you, let's say, live in California and you have to pay private schools to educate your kids because of the disaster out there in public education, but then you move to Texas, and in Texas you get to use school choice, so in a sense it's cheaper to educate your kids here that is going to be another reason why people are going to be moving from places like California, not just to Texas, but Arizona also has school choice. Florida, I'm sure, will have it, Georgia. So that's another reason. There's going to be an economic effect of parents benefiting and therefore taking their kids to another, you know, being more inclined to move to another state, Bill.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Now, of course, we should point out that school choice requires there to be schools to choose.
Right.
And that is going to depend on the willingness of people to build new schools, to recruit new teachers, to establish schools that are different from the ordinary schools that they've been getting. And that is something that's the next challenge, because you can be sure that the people who oppose on this, the teachers unions and the old lefties, are going to make it or try to make it impossible to build new schools. This is a battle that only begins with the election of new school board members.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't end there. The leftist ideology is a fanatical ideology. It really has become something of a religion, and no matter what is shown about the result of that ideology, which is often catastrophic, they will still continue to believe it. And so this is a fight that is ongoing.
Well, it's their jobs they're fighting for. I mean, it is interesting that the teachers union seems to be more interested in their jobs than in their mission. Their mission is to educate.
Yes.
So in a way, what is happening to the school, the teachers union, is that they've become a monopoly. So what usually happens with a monopoly is that they don't care about their customer because their customer is there, guaranteed. So they become obsessed with themselves. And that's what I think, that's where the teachers union went wrong, when they started thinking more about their leadership and themselves and politics, when they got away from the idea that their job was to teach kids. I don't know when that happened in the timeline, but I can guarantee you that, you know, I had kids in school, let's say 15 to 20 years ago, and the school board meetings or the teachers union then was not what it is now, Bill.
No.
I mean, it's a lot more radical now and way more political now than it was, I don't know, 20 years ago, Bill, when I dealt with issues like that.
Well, that's true. But I remember back in the 1960s when the teachers unions first got started, that we didn't always have teachers unions, and many people were against them, just as many people, good people who cared about working folks, were against public service unions for a variety of good reasons. Franklin Roosevelt was against public service unions. So was George Meany of the labor movement. But in the case of schools, there was a special worry that what would happen was what eventually did happen, and that is the unions would become a force apart, less interested in children than in their own benefits. Now, when the unions first got started, the most influential organizer was a man named Albert Shanker, and was the source of some ridicule at times. But Albert Shanker was a very serious educator and wrote a number of very fine columns about education, paid for by the union when the unions first got started. And in the first years, perhaps even the first decades of teachers' unions, as they began to spread, I think they handled themselves pretty responsibly. But then inevitably, the unions were taken over by far leftists. The schools of education, which is sometimes called teachers' colleges, where most teachers are trained, got taken over by very radical people. I mean, the Columbia University Teachers College, Columbia Teachers College, which I don't believe is still associated with Columbia, became really a Marxist institution. So these people who want to become teachers go to these teachers' colleges, and they are radicalized first. And then
right.
They radicalize the students. And they are taught an entirely different ethic of the role of the teacher than the teachers we had. And
right.
Standards, there's no question, standards in many schools are lower than they were at one time. The people who are hurt the most are the minority kids, because they had told that they're going to be given special attention now. They're going to finally have a place in history, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this all turns out to be nonsense, because we have been giving high school diplomas to minority kids who can only read at the eighth grade level. That's not progress.
Right. No, not at all. You're not helping these kids at all when you do that. In fact,
of course not.
You're hurting them. You're making life very miserable for them because they're not going to be able to get a job. I think you remember the story, Bill. You may have printed this a year or so ago. In the city of Baltimore, there was a kid who graduated from school with less than a 1.0 GPA.
Yes.
I mean, the kid had failed just about every class. You know, he couldn't even, you know, complete an application for a job. And yet
kid
graduated, and he was not alone. There were several others. But I can just tell you from personal experience that when our kids were in high school or grade school, that to me the teachers' union was just, you know, this organization that would take care of the teachers, make sure they're getting their raises and their bonuses and that kind of thing. And it all sounded pretty harmless to me and pretty noble. But somewhere along the way, these people, like you were saying, they got radicalized. And it's almost like they're teaching them to hate their country, Bill. That's what I find appalling. They're teaching them to hate their country. Well, if you hate the country, how in the world can you live in the country, Bill?
That's right. The word that you're not allowed to use since about 1955 in this country is the word communist. But the reality is there are many of them around. I think they have a perfect right to espouse Marxism as individuals. I think they have a perfect right to vote for the Communist Party if they want to. I don't think they have the right to lie about what they're doing, though, and inject this stuff into our children's brains.
No, you're right about that, and I'm glad to see that a lot of parents are waking up to that reality, because that was one tsunami we did have. We did have a tsunami at the school boards from coast to coast, and I was very proud of the parents who feel that they have to get involved like that. Let's take a little break, Bill. When we come back, I want to talk about Nancy Pelosi, and I want to talk about the article that you wrote about Iran. So we'll be right back with our friend Bill. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, sharing a little Thanksgiving, a pre-Thanksgiving conversation with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I want to go back to Thanksgiving for a quick second before we move on. You know, the pilgrims, what I guess they're called settlers now, as you're saying, they settled in Massachusetts, I guess, and they're called invaders or whatever they're called, but the people who got here, didn't these people also get to North America from they crossed the Siberian or whatever it was and came all the way down here? Didn't they settle the continent too from whoever was here before? So it's like you say, there was plenty of room to settle this place, and it was never an argument before, and all of a sudden now it's a big argument, Bill. Now they call it indigenous people, whatever that means, whatever that means.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's kind of a made-up phrase. It's being used around the world now, and we owe them, and we owe this, and we owe that, and I mean, it reminds me of the argument for reparations for African Americans. Nobody denies that African Americans, many of whom were brought here as slaves, suffered. But we have paid out as a nation in social programs far beyond what reparations would normally pay. And also, many of the people who live in America today, probably most of the people who live in America today, were not only not here during the age of slavery, their ancestors weren't here during the age of slavery. I mean, and they're asking the question, my people weren't here until 1920 why should I pay reparations?
Right.
The answer that usually comes back is, well, you benefited from slavery. You benefited from the results of slavery. One can make that argument. There's some legitimacy there. But if that's true, then all the free blacks also benefited from the age
mm-hmm.
of slavery. Are we going to make them pay reparations? I don't think so. Now,
right.
The state of California is now structured legally to prepare for reparations because the governor has signed into law a bill identifying African Americans as a separate people. I don't think we've ever done that in American history. It's certainly an ugly thing to do, but it was demanded, and in the Democratic Party, when you demand and you're somebody, you get what you want. Now, that apparently is to allow people to be identified for the receipt of reparations. I think reparations would be a horrible idea. I have no problem at all with looking at social needs and meeting them if the government is in the business of meeting those needs and doing it well so that the individual African American benefits. I'm certainly not in favor of just sending out checks.
Right.
That would be the resentments would be so great that it wouldn't be worth it.
Right. Well, the other thing too, Bill, the biggest reparation I think that was made or paid was the opportunity that was offered to these people. I mean, if you're an African American person today and you're 20 years old, you have opportunities that your grandfather or great-grandfather never had.
That's
so
exactly
the opportunity
right.
to go to college, to do something. I mean, so the reparations came in the form of opportunities. Affirmative action that I remember in the 1970s came into existence. And at first, you know, I thought affirmative action, there was a reason for, you know, basically balancing things. So I can understand that. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about now is send me a check. Well,
yes.
that's not going to happen. But, Bill, we may be sending checks to third world countries because of global warming. So that's one reparation that they're talking about out there.
Well, it is amazing, isn't it? That is
yes.
something that the president signed, but there are very serious constitutional questions as to whether he has the right to just designate billions of dollars to be sent to foreign countries that we have apparently abused because of climate. And this is complete craziness. John Kerry is involved in it, naturally. I mean, he's our climate czar. I don't know what he's the czar of. But he's involved in it, and apparently it will come out of the federal treasury. We won't feel it. Of course we're going to feel it. But if the idea is ridiculous, I want to know if we're going to give any money to any foreign country, exactly where it's going to go, who is going to benefit from it. You can be sure the ordinary people of these countries will benefit from nothing. Most of these third world countries are run by little tin horn dictators. Why are we doing it, and why is there not outrage on the part of the press, a press that really has become almost useless to its basic function? I think that as the American people begin to understand that, there will be resentment. We now will have a House of Representatives that appropriates funds, and I think that through the appropriations process, they may be able to stop it.
Well, I hope so, because you make an excellent point. I mean, where does the president of the United States get the authority to hand out checks like this? The last time I recall or read the Constitution, there was something called a treaty. I mean,
yes.
if this had happened because of a treaty, of course it would never happen because they would never get the votes for that. But I don't even remember Democrats in the House voting for reparations of this type based on climate change. Sometimes, Bill, I get the feeling sometimes that, and I'm not sure how much President Biden is behind this, but he's the one signing it. But I don't know whether it's him or the people around him. But I get the feeling sometimes that they are just signing things and making these announcements, knowing that they're going to be overturned in the courts, and then they can blame somebody for the fact that it didn't happen. Because
that's right.
I mean, that's what they're doing with the college loans thing. They're blaming it now, I guess, on the Republicans. And I guarantee you they're going to blame it on the Republicans if the Congress says you don't have the authority to do this, and then they can say to their people, look, I tried to do something about climate change, but those terrible Republicans let me do it, didn't let me do it, Bill.
Well, that's an old political trick. I think it probably will be employed. I also think that the president may not be completely aware of what he's signing. You know, I think there are very legitimate questions as to who the big powers are in this administration. And I have always felt right from the beginning that in foreign policy, it's Barack Obama. If you look at the people who are manning the outposts and have the jobs in the administration in foreign policy, they are mostly his people. And I think that he has great influence behind the scenes in what we do. And what we've done and what we're doing is not very healthy for the United States. I mean, we are still supposedly interested in an arms deal with Iran, which has become a militantly terrorist country, which will get billions of dollars if a deal goes through, and yet still no reaction from the American press.
Right. Well, you mentioned a couple of days ago, yesterday, I think you wrote an article called The Forgotten Iranians.
Yes.
And how, you know, you have an Iran, and taking place in Iran, a real, you know, revolution. I mean, that is a revolution. Those are people in the streets risking their lives, such as their soccer team at the World Cup, not singing the national anthem. That takes courage. That takes
it
courage.
Does.
When you've got Western reporters complaining about that Qatar doesn't let you wear this or let you wear that, that's not courage, because nothing's going to happen to these reporters. They're going to be, at worst, they may get deported, but nothing's going to happen to them. But those young men in that soccer team who didn't do the, I mean, you know that there's going to be consequences for them or their families probably. So that takes courage. But, you know, the media is obsessed with Qatar and LGBT, but nobody seems to care about what's happening in Iran, Bill.
Well, that's a remarkable thing, isn't it? We have now gone through several months of violent protests. There are a few mild denunciations from the Obama-Biden administration, but not more than that. Most Americans don't care. Most American news outlets barely cover the story. There are, presumably, according to the UN, 300 people who have been killed. They don't seem to count for anything. Many of the demonstrations have been led by women, but there has not been a single statement, to the best of my knowledge, by any women's organization in the United States, which may confirm what many people felt about women's organizations and have felt all along, that, yes, they're interested in women on occasion, but their real goal is to be interested in the spread, is being interested in the spread of Marxism.
Right.
I do see some good coverage of Iran on CNN, by the way. I'm not a fan of CNN, but I give credit where it's due. I've seen some good reporting from Iran. But not from anybody else. They just don't care. They care only about something that can be used to advance the interests of the political left. And this is a situation where if you're going to go all out against the regime in Iran, you're going all out against the policies of the Biden administration, and that they won't do.
Right. But if you compare, for example, what's happening in Iran, where the media seems to have no interest, even though there's women being tortured and they're being harassed and some women are being killed. And then compare that, for example, with the way South Africa was treated. I mean, in South Africa, you know, that became an obsession with the media. And again, I'm not saying that it shouldn't have been, because what was happening in South Africa was not good. But I what's happening in Iran is not good either, but other than Urgent Agenda, Bill, and a couple of other places, I don't see it anywhere, the coverage of what's happening in Iran, Bill.
That's exactly right. I mean, the press plays favorites. The inequality of coverage is simply breathtaking. I mean, the number, for example, in South Africa, which used to be given all kinds of coverage during the apartheid system, when once apartheid ended, the Western reporters just pulled their plugs and left. After all, apartheid was over. Isn't that good? I mean, isn't it wonderful? Never noticing who took over the country. It was a bunch of old Marxist revolutionaries who had no idea how to run anything. The murder rate in South Africa of African people is ghastly. It's in the thousands every year. Nobody has any interest. Those black lives apparently don't matter. And then they call themselves journalists for doing this.
Right.
But the inequality of coverage, which has become a staple of the Western press, is one of the great scandals of our time. But we depend on a free press to report on it, and a free press is not going to do it.
Yeah, but somebody's got to be making the decision not to run those stories, because if I was a journalist at CNN or whatever, or an international news organization, I would be interested in running the story because it is an interesting story. Here you have women, women, it's amazing. Women are the ones leading that revolution. You would think that there'd be a bunch of feminists, a bunch of women at CNN or whatever would be interested in this. But apparently somebody at the top says, no, we're not going to run that story. I mean, that's the only thing I can imagine, Bill.
Well, I'm afraid that's the case. You know, the people who run news organizations today were the college students and the children of college students of the 1960s. And what you're seeing is the impact of the 1960s. We knew when it occurred that all this wreckage that was being left would have an impact down the line. We didn't know how many years it would take before that generation would actually get into power. I think they started getting into power, probably in mid-80s or so, and we just didn't notice what was happening. There were some who noticed. There was a book written in the 1980s by a Yale professor called The Closing of the American Mind that was beginning to take account of what was happening in our universities. It became a bestseller. It was written as an academic thesis, but a big bestseller, so people were noticing, but not enough people cared. And I'm sorry to say that included the Republican Party. They just did not give any attention to what was happening in educational institutions, and it is something that needs to be criticized, because that's where the ideas of society are formed and are challenged and are destroyed.
That's right. I think the book you're talking about is Alan Bloom was the author,
that's
I think,
right.
Was it? Yeah, that's because I remember reading that book. I thought it was a pretty heavy book when I remember reading it, and it was one of those books that were not difficult to read, but I call them heavy books. They're the kind of books that you have to go back and read it a few times because
it was an academic book.
Exactly. It's the kind of book that I guess you have to be really smart to understand, but the idea that he was presenting was a good one. A couple of more topics, Bill, I want to get into today, Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. And with respect to President Trump, I guess we know he's running, and he's now going to be investigated by a special counsel. But they're also they're going to be looking at his taxes, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. What exactly are they going to find in his taxes? I continue to ask myself the question, how many more times is this guy supposed to be investigated? Look, I mean, anybody with any idea of what the business world is like knows that Donald Trump's businesses have been looked at by, you know, international law firms, international accounting firms. Those are the people who do his taxes. And it's hard for me to believe that those firms are going to put their reputation on the line to save Donald Trump $100. I mean, they're going to say to Donald Trump, this is the way it is. This is the law. Now, they're going to try to take advantage of whatever law is out there. I get that. That happens. I mean, when you go down to do your taxes, they try to do that. But what exactly are they looking at? It just, you know, I think, I don't know. But, I mean, at some point, they have to stop investigating this man, Bill.
Well, that's true. I mean, this is abusive. It bears a very strong relationship to what we used to call McCarthyism, which was really an abuse of the federal investigative process, the legislative investigative process by Joe McCarthy. And it's very much the same thing. They pick on this guy. In this case, the tax investigation, I believe, is being conducted by New York State, which, of course, is an entirely Democratic-run state. And they claim that there are things that will result in indictments. Well, they might. They might, and I'd like to know where those indictments will be entered, because if Donald Trump is indicted in Washington, D.C., he has almost no chance of winning his case. Washington, D.C. is a Democratic, left-wing-run institution. If he's indicted somewhere else, maybe he has a better chance. But I mean, you know, you're right. His company has been in business, and it's really, I think, a product of his father's company, Fred Trump. They've been in business in New York for many decades, and I don't recall any time that they've ever been in serious trouble. So
right.
You would think that somebody looking at this would say, you know, either they're very clean or they have very good lawyers who keep them clean. I have no doubt that there was some hanky-panky going on. There almost always is. But when you start investigating a major political figure, especially an elected figure and the highest elected figure like the president, you better have your facts in order. You really should, because then you're starting to interfere in the political process.
Right. Well, I guess that what the Supreme Court said is that the Congress can look at his taxes. I think that's what they said, and that may be theoretically correct. That may be the right decision. But what I'm hoping is that this new Congress coming in says, okay, put those taxes over there because we got more important things to look at. What bothers the heck out of me is that this man, like you say, his father, his family, they never had any tax problems before when they were donating to Democrats, Bill.
Right. Yes. Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing?
I've noticed that. I mean, well. Look, real estate in New York is to New York what oil is to Texas. It's the home industry, and you know, as they say, they're not going to make any more land. And the real estate organizations in New York, the real estate boards, they are very heavily committed politically. Usually, people give to each party just to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
And those there's no question. Campaign contributions buy influence. Of course they do. It's one of the flaws in our system. And instead of trying to fix the flaw, we are told that we must investigate only Donald Trump. We must not investigate Joe Biden because there's nothing there. Although CBS this week finally admitted there was something there.
Right.
This is the house. They call themselves the House of Murrow. A lot of these guys couldn't get a job as a personal assistant to Ed Murrow. Were real reporters back in those days. They reported on world wars. But so CBS finally has come through for us and admitted maybe there's something not right about Hunter Biden's computer.
Right. Well, of course, that led to Babylon Bee to publish one of their great headlines saying that CBS had just confirmed that Lincoln was, in fact, assassinated or something like that.
They were responsible journalists. They waited for confirmation.
Right.
And they finally got it in a book written 104 years ago, and they now can say with some safety, because they're fine journalists, with some safety, that Lincoln was, in fact, assassinated.
Yeah. I have problems with Trump. I'm not ready to support him in 2024. I think that his time may have passed. But I think that for the good of the country, this craziness about Trump has got to stop. You know, we cannot go on like this where the man is being investigated, you know, in the state of New York. I think there's probably people in New York who wish that the Attorney General would focus more on crime in New York City than in looking at the businesses of Donald Trump, Bill.
Silvio, everyone knows there's no crime in New York City. This is all being made up. It's all for television news organizations. Why, New York at 3 o'clock in the morning is the place I want to be. I mean, do you realize that that's what people are being told in New York, that there really is no crime problem, that this is all politics? I mean, people, especially in minority communities, are afraid to go out. They're afraid to send their children to school. But there's no crime. It's all being made up.
Right.
I mean, that is the mentality that allowed the city of New York to go into a gubernatorial election and elect the very same people who are doing nothing about crime.
Right. No, I agree. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what happened in that city. Well, one last story, Bill, I wanted to mention is, as we have Thanksgiving upon us, is we have a lot of reasons to be thankful. And one of my reasons, after family and everything else, good health and good friends and everything else, good food, everything else, I am really thankful that Nancy Pelosi is history, or will soon be history, because I don't have a problem with politicians being partisan. That's part of the game. But I always felt that Nancy Pelosi went beyond that, that she was really divisive in ways that are not good for the country, that she was not Tip O'Neill or Paul Ryan or somebody like that, people that had ideas and ideology. But I always thought she went too far, Bill. So I'm kind of glad she's gone. I'm not going to miss her one bit, Bill.
No, she had a remarkable career, and she did make history, quote, as the first woman House Speaker and all the rest. But she was intensely partisan, and she looked the other way when things were done in the Democratic Party that really were not in the interest of the country. Her intense partisanship is what I will not miss. I think that Kevin McCarthy will now become Speaker. There may be a dispute over that in the Republican Party, and it's always possible that he may not become Speaker, but whoever it is will be a Republican. There's even a suggestion, by the way, that the Republicans go outside the House to select a Speaker. You don't have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker of the House. And I think that could be a unique idea and maybe a very history-making idea. But I think the Republicans will be partisan, but I think they will be more reasonable because they are not reporting to a crazy constituency.
Right. And no, I always thought Nancy Pelosi went too far. Like, you know, I thought the first impeachment of Trump was a disaster. It should have never happened. It should have never been put to a vote. And then, of course, like that time when she was ripping the speech behind him that time, I thought that was extremely, extremely bad. Just her overall demeanor was bad.
Yes,
very
bad taste.
Yeah, I just felt that she went out of her way. And, I just don't think the country needs that. Here's my idea, Bill, for a Speaker of the House. Lee Zeldin. You've heard about that, I think. Him. I would put him. That would be the perfect compromise, Bill.
It would be, and he is leaving Congress. So he's a member of Congress right now. He will be leaving because he didn't run for reelection. So he ran for governor of New York. Did a spectacular job campaigning. Highly respected. He would be a wonderful choice to be Speaker. Some people have suggested that Donald Trump be elected Speaker of the House. I don't think so, but you can once you realize you can elect anyone as Speaker, it could be a wonderful discussion as to who deserves to be Speaker. I would think there are also many Republican women who could become Speaker of the House. The Republican Party now has loads of women in high positions. And I think, wouldn't that be interesting if they chose somebody like Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, or some of the women who become major figures in conservative politics? I'm all for it. If Kevin does not get the votes for whatever reason, because he doesn't satisfy a particular bloc, I say let's go outside the House and elect somebody really important who could bring something to the job. Now, of course, the Democrats will immediately nominate Oprah Winfrey, but I really don't think that would do it. I really don't.
No, but, you know, a couple more things about the Speaker of the House. Number one, he or she is number three in the seniority, or in the whatever they call that, in the chain of command. So, I mean, it is a person who could, under the most unusual circumstances, become president. So, I mean, it's an important job. And the other thing, that if Lee Zeldin were to become the Speaker, and I love the idea, by the way, if he were to become the Speaker, he's almost like a cinch to be running for president or be somebody's vice president, Bill.
Oh, yeah.
That's very true. Because Lee Zeldin has really put himself, he ran such a great campaign that he's put himself in a very special place. And I will say this, 2 weeks ago when we were doing our pre-game show, our pre-election show, if you had said to me that the Republican House majority was going to be a consequence of New York election, the election in New York or California, I would have never believed it. But that is, in fact, what's happened. They're going to have a majority of 8 to 9 votes, and it's all going to be because of New York and California, Bill.
Yeah. History is strange, isn't it?
It really is. Can you imagine anybody proposing that 2 weeks ago? I wouldn't have believed it.
No. We talk about the red wave, which didn't materialize nationally, but as many people here have pointed out, it did materialize in New York. They knocked out four Democratic members of Congress. So
that's right.
I think that's a great idea, Lee Zeldin, the Speaker.
Well, I'm all for it. So tomorrow when you're eating your turkey, think about that. And think about Lee Zeldin being the Speaker of the House, because I'm all with you. I'm with you on that one. Bill, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. And again, thank you so much for joining us in these chats. One of the things that I'm grateful for is the fact that you and I have chatted for several years. It's become a really fun thing for me to do every week and valuable thing for me. So thank you for your friendship. My best to you and to your family. And thank you for Urgent Agenda. And, I'll send you a photo. I'll send you a photo of the grandchildren so you can enjoy that too.
Absolutely. I'd love that. And I appreciate everything that you've done to make this program so successful. And we will go on to higher things in the new year.
Well, we will. Well, at least not in the new year, but certainly next Monday.
Right.
Okay. We don't have to wait till next year. We can get it started next Monday. So
let's do it.
So let's do it. Thank you, Bill. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, I always enjoy chatting with him. And happy Thanksgiving to all of you. All of you have a great day and enjoy yourself and say thanks for the things you have. They're good things. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.